With your help, we can continue to fight for freedom. This is not possible without your generosity. Join our quest for the truth and our freedom and donate today. Simply go to tntradio.live. Weekends with Alan Miller on today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
Back, everyone. I'm Alan Miller. This is TNT Radio. And we are in the midst of talking about all sorts of things around innovation, development, productivity, wealth creation for all. And that was a great first hour with James Woodhouse and full of interesting ideas and about the many challenges that we face. And obviously, the discussions around low traffic neighborhoods, about ultra-low emission zones. And by the way, have you seen the piece in The Express talking about the leak that the BBC is just pumping out things? And they use the term in collusion with Sadiq Khan, but putting things out even when journalists have concerns about it. Very interesting. But where these measures are imposed upon us and the questions around democracy, all those things crucial in terms of the questions about net zero or not, which we touched on in the first hour of the show. In the second hour, we're going to talk more about some of these issues and about practical campaigning, about public debate, winning over people to the discussion about where the public sits within all of this. So I'm very pleased that I'm joined by my next guest because Alistair Donald is the Associate Director of the Academy of Ideas and is a convener of the Battle of Ideas Festival, which if those of you around the world, it's worth visiting Britain precisely in October to come to that, make that part of your visit. And anyone in the United Kingdom should come along to it. It's a fantastic two-day festival. He's also Secretary of Ideas Matter and a convener of Living Freedom, which is the annual residential school for young people to explore the meaning and ideals of freedom in the 21st century. And I spoke there last year and I was really impressed with the caliber of people that were there. And I will be speaking again there on Friday, the 30th of June, when the next one's on. It's really a fantastic initiative. Just to say that Alistair's also worked internationally across the UK, not just developing festivals, exhibitions and programmes, but he's also an author of such publications as The Scottish Question. He's published a series of letters on liberty. And he's also co-editor of a couple of books, The Lure of the City, From the Slums to the Suburbs and The Future of Community. Reports of Death Greatly Exaggerated. All of that, as well as being a co-director of the Future Cities Project, which has also published a manifesto towards a humanism in architecture, which makes Alistair an interesting person to talk to. Alistair, thank you for joining us today. How are you doing?
Yeah, fine, thanks. Thanks for having me on, Alan.
Well, I suppose firstly, just if why don't we start with what's going on with Living Freedom. Do you want to tell us a bit about what it's about and just give us a bit of background about what Living Freedom is, if you would?
Yes, of course. It's an initiative that was set up by the educational charity that I work for called Ideas Matter, set up in 2017, I think it was. And we recognize that for young people, there's a bit of a problem in terms of there are opportunities to get to grips and discuss some of the key issues of freedom. And we thought we could set up a summer school that would bring 40, 50 people together outside of the confines of their work or at university or wherever it is that they happen to be hanging out and give them a space to engage with some of these ideas, both in terms of the history and the philosophy of freedom. So we have lecturers who come in and talk about some of the key ideas across the course of history in terms of freedom and some of the key thinkers and give them an opportunity to discuss those ideas, not just in the sense of purely history, but in the sense of trying to work out how relevant some of those ideas might be today and what we can take from those great thinkers of the past and use to understand our own world a little bit better and to make the case for freedom today. So there's a history and philosophy element to what we do. And then there's also an element of discussing contemporary issues around freedom. And of course, there's so many just now that are controversial topics from identity politics and cancel culture through to some of the more recent initiatives in terms of the state being exposed really as taking a lead in terms of really trampling on people's rights and trampling on people's ability to express themselves. So it's a 3 days for, and we've expanded in the time since we started. So it's no longer just 40 people. We've got 75 people gathering in London on Thursday. They're going to come from all around the UK, but also around Europe as well. We've got people from Spain and Switzerland and Denmark and a couple of other countries, and also from America and Canada. So it's going to be hopefully a really vibrant, intense, I think, experience across the course of 3 days, where lots of discussions are going to happen. All the people there have, as a starting point, an interest in freedom and issues of free speech. Why would you apply to a freedom school otherwise? But beyond that, I suspect that they're all quite different, actually, in terms of what they think about the world, what their political views are, what their main interests in terms of freedom are. I think we've got a really mixed crowd that's going to come along, which should make for hopefully an eventful 3 days, because the onus is very much on the people that are there to work out some of the answers for themselves. I mean, we can invite interesting speakers, and we have invited lots of interesting speakers. Around 40 actually are going to be taking part in the event. But really, they give relatively short talks and lectures. You know, if we have an hour session, then someone might get 20 minutes to do a lecture. But 40 minutes of that time is then to discuss what is raised in that lecture. And there's a real onus on people to work through these issues and try and understand things better and develop their own ideas. And I think more broadly, we're in a situation with freedom and free speech just now where we really intellectually need to work out how it is that we defend freedom in the 21st century. Because, as I say, we give lectures on history and philosophy, but that's in the past, and we face a whole new set of issues today.
Well, last year I actually sat in on some of those lectures, and I listened to Arif Ahmed, who is the Cambridge a professor, who did a brilliant overview, and I was like, gosh, this is fantastic. I wish he'd been one of my lecturers. And he's now a free speech czar. And so I suppose my question to you is, and then some people like Open Democracy say he really represents a war on universities, that this free speech point that you make, and I know that it goes to the heart of many of the events that you organize and you're involved with and debates you do, it's now presented in a very kind of instrumental way, isn't it? It's sort of like that some people say you want to kind of offend people or upset people. It's the sort of irresponsible people that want to be nasty. But it seems like the old idea that both the left used to have, whatever the left is now, but this sense that free speech was essential for our freedoms, has really gone away. And in America, it's particularly troubled, even though it's sort of enshrined in the Constitution. And in the UK, I mean, when you have things like a czar being brought in, is that because things are just so terrible? How do you see the situation for free speech? Do you think we're improving in the fight for it, or do you think it's being suffocated even more? How do you actually see it at the moment?
Well, in terms of the so-called czar, which is, I think, formal title of director of free speech within the Office for Students, I mean, it is the case that universities and institutions, educational institutions, are under a formal duty to protect free speech and to protect all ideas within the sphere of the university. After all, that's what universities are intended to be for young people to go along and to be able to engage once beyond their years in school, be able to engage as young adults in the world of ideas, and of course for academics and lecturers to be able to research and to pursue the type of interest that they have to where that interest takes them, which, you know, inevitably leads you beyond the boundaries of what's deemed relatively mainstream or acceptable or all the rest of it. So formally, universities are under that duty to facilitate that. Of course, the reality is that, as we all know, and as we all endlessly hear about in the newspapers, we're in so many situations today where universities do not seem to be fulfilling that objective, partly because of some very high profile no platformings or deplatformings, where people are invited and then disinvited, and so on and so forth. But I think probably more importantly, because the culture within universities, and I think this goes for broader society just now, is one that doesn't recognize the importance and the benefits of free speech. And such is the way that free speech is looked upon as a problem. So I don't think just free speech is not just curtailed, it's actively seen as a problem, because if you express some opinions, then you're deemed a bigot, or you're deemed to be discriminatory. So free speech is seen as a problem. And you can understand, once free speech is seen as a problem, then people go out of their way to curtail it and to make sure that students, for example, are protected. I mean, the idea these days is very much that students are a little bit fragile, that they suffer from mental health problems, that they're not able to deal with ideas. I mean, the very idea of being an adult and having to deal with them seems to have, we seem to have regressed from that idea. So even within a university, over the age of 18, you're really treated as children who are only should be allowed to hear ideas that won't upset them. So I and we as an organization have a little bit more confidence in young people. We think that they're quite capable of dealing with difficult ideas. They're quite capable of responding to them where they don't like them in a constructive way. And all of these things should be matters of debate. And I think, you know, to go back to the free speech czar question, I was a bit conflicted in terms of the government's academic freedom bill, because in many ways you think, well, we really need a culture in society that's supportive of free speech, and you think possibly it's going to be difficult to impose that just because there's a bit of legislation or a few people in government who want to see it. But on the other hand, I can see why it's been done, because there needs to be some mechanism that has a legal bound to it that is used as a hook to hopefully promote and get universities into a situation where ideas are much more discussed, and even controversial ones. So on balance, I think it's probably a good thing, but I don't think any of us can be hoodwinked by the fact that it's happened and expect that everything's just going to be okay, because I think the bigger problem is that we culturally have turned against free speech, and that's really the issue that I think that we need to address.
Point. I know several years ago, I was involved in nighttime lobbying to get 24-hour cities to work and work with stakeholders, and we wanted to have ambassadors of some kind work with mayors and with local authorities and with the Home Office and that type of thing, combining what they'd done in Germany and in Amsterdam and in Berlin. And we brought those guys over and explained it. But we kind of advocated that people would be voted for, but or at least independent. And, you know, we started having nighttime czars coming up, or ambassadors, they were called different things. And some of them, you could see that what would happen was that it would be in keeping with whoever was appointing them and with their views, and actually some of the really thorny, tricky issues that you have to kind of challenge and speak up about and against often did not happen. And even then, your point, the really crucial point, is if the public insists on things, then legal mechanisms take a bit of a back seat, right? So if the public are all saying this is so paramount or fundamental, this is essential, core part of who we are and what we insist on, then in a way, I sort of agreeing with you. I think a lot of the measures, for instance, and we can see it in different areas, this is different, but obviously around the protests, the bills that have been put through to limit protests and things like that because of an inability to implement or unwillingness to implement laws that already exist. That thing about resuscitating the cultural bit is really important. And I think I'm assuming that what you would say is that that's what you're doing also with the Academy of Ideas, the Battle of Ideas Festival, to engage the public in these debates. Do you want to tell us a bit about what's happening with that in October as well? What happens at the Battle of Ideas Festival? Give us an overview.
Battle of Ideas Festival this year is the 28th and the 29th of October in London in Church House. Tickets are on sale already. If you visit the website battleofideas.org.uk, then you can find the ticket page and get your ticket for the weekend. The tickets are very cheap, I think, for a whole weekend festival, even for people paying full price. They're only around £100, but lots of opportunities to buy tickets much cheaper than that for students and school pupils and so on and so forth. What you won't yet find on the website is the programme for this year's Battle of Ideas, which is currently under development. We have about, well, 2 weeks ago, we had about 150 ideas for sessions. We've managed to whittle that down a little bit now to around 90, 100, which will be the final programme. And what we're doing at the moment is just developing all of those ideas into sessions that will take place throughout the course of the weekend. And the way that we organise the festival is through putting on strands of debates that people can come along, and if they've got a particular interest in, say, arts and culture or the economy or international affairs, then they can follow a strand of debates on all of those issues throughout the day. Or what a lot of people do, and this is kind of, I suppose we sort of think of it a little bit as the Glastonbury of ideas festivals, they can pick and mix a little bit and go to all sorts of different things, because at any one time during the festival we have about 9 or 10 different debates. And we usually, the format we usually use is to have panels so that we can assemble people of a variety of different views, that they're not like school debating motions as such, but much more chances for it to make some intellectual provocations on a particular topic. And this year we've got, so many ideas, but some of the big things that we'll be looking at is things like freedom of conscience, progress, international affairs, obviously the situation in Ukraine what's happening today, of course, is very much of interest in terms of that. We'll have sessions on the economy and why it seems to be going to hell in a handcart so quickly, with so few people seemingly with any real idea about how it is that we can address some of these fundamental economic issues. In arts and culture, we'll have all sorts of things, but one of the sessions that we're going to almost certainly do is why classical music these days is seen as elitist and why it's snobby to be interested in classical music. We're going to have sessions on things like updating old books and this whole way that sensitivity readers are used by publishers. So really,
that's something very close to my heart. Alistair, I'm going to just pause you for a second. We're going to go to a quick break. I'm Alan Miller. I'm here with Alistair Donald. This is TNT Radio. Come join us right after this break.
TNT Radio's Patrick Henningsen.
The big NATO drill is underway. Air Defender, we're already getting reports of assets being moved around the perimeter of Ukraine. It looks like with the NATO summit coming up in Vilnius, they're planning a big event, ladies and gentlemen. So I'm just telling you straight up right now that something's going to happen. So, I mean, I don't say that casually. I know like people are doing all sorts of provocations online, clickbaiting and so forth. If you look at the history and what's happened over the last couple of months and right back to last summer with Baltops 22, where they wired the Nord Stream with explosives and then blew it a couple of months later. The NATO summit's huge. They know they're losing. They have to show to each other and to themselves and to their respective ministries and their various member state governments that it's not going to be a total massive defeat. So they're going to do something crazy. These people will do anything but negotiate for peace. We are in an insane period of history where these clowns are running clown world governments. They're doubling down on every bad decision they've ever made, just like they have throughout history. It's just that the stakes are even higher today because we're dealing with nuclear weapons.
Patrick Henningsen on today's News Talk, TNT Radio.
Radio works because of its ability to personalize to the listener.
What's exciting these days is that people are rediscovering it. People are really rediscovering just how powerful radio is, how ubiquitous it is. It's in our cars, it's in our homes. There are so many new ways to access it. It's everywhere.
To find out more, go to tntradio.live. You're listening to The Alan Miller Show on today's News Talk, TNT Radio.
Welcome back. I'm Alan Miller. I'm joined by Alistair Donald. We've been talking about Living Freedom, which is happening next Friday, the 30th June, and also the Battle of Ideas Festival on the at the end of October, which you can see on my handle links to that people can come and join. And I would encourage you all to do that. One thing that I really value about the festival is the willingness to have all sorts of different views discussed and represented. But we've got a problem, haven't we, Alistair? Because that is much more now we see name calling. And I'm not into banning name calling or any of that, but it's like we're seeing smears, we're seeing suffocation. We've seen from the Twitter files, the lockdown files, we've seen that there's been spy units. There still is one with the CDU, that Orwellian term, via the DCMS. There was the rapid response unit from the cabinet. We've seen citizens, doctors, journalists, the public have in positions in terms of not just physically, but also in terms of what they can say. So whilst these discussions, debates are important, this has been a very worrying moment, hasn't it? Well, how do you see this? What do you think, you know, I know this is a difficult question, but how do you think the public sees this, right? You're trying to engage with the public quite a lot. And how do you think they see what's just happened this last period? Is it just a few people having this conversation? How do you see all of that?
Well, I think the stuff that's coming out just now around the spy units within government has probably shocked a lot of people. I don't think people thought that Britain, home of democracy, as many people see it, would be under the watchful eye of surreptitious state organizations that are set up to spy on them. So I think this has probably come as a little bit of a shock to some people. And it's an interesting revelation, I think. I mean, on the one hand, we've got this strange situation today where on the one hand, the state just seems completely and utterly dysfunctional to me. We can't build houses. We bumble our way through responding to things like the onset of a virus, having supposedly prepared for it for 10 years and just seem incapable of implementing policies that might deal with it effectively and efficiently and then move on and get on with our lives. So the state on the one hand just seems completely dysfunctional. On the other hand, it seems to be have a dystopian edge to it, where some of these surveillance methods have come in. And of course, as you mentioned, we should recognize that this has been happening in America as well. And we've had speaking in London a couple of nights ago, we had Matt Taibbi and Michael Schellenberger, who were talking about some of the work that they've been doing in America, which is exposing similar sorts of things to what's been going on in the UK, where the FBI and other state agencies have been raking through people's personal communications or their social media and acting alongside big tech companies to shadow ban and undermine people's capacity to engage with things. So I think some of this is probably coming as a little bit of a shock. The problem is that in the situation of the culture wars, often we're drawn to support whichever side of the culture wars that we happen to be on. So even although this is happening, some people would see it, and people might be slightly nervous about it, they see a bigger problem in terms of their opponents on the other side of the culture wars and what's going on with them. So I'm sure some Democrats, some people on the left in the UK, are eyeing these things thinking, God, what's going on? But at the same time, because they have a belief that those on the right and conservatives or Republicans are the bigger threat, then perhaps they're a little bit more willing to support what's going on. So I think we need to have a much bigger conversation about these things. I think it's not clear how you resolve these things. I mean, one of my thoughts from the meeting the other night in London was that it didn't really in any way resolve how to respond to these things. And I think part of that is because there's a bigger discussion on politics that's missing from these things. I mean, in the past, censorship is not a new thing. Censorship from the state is certainly not a new thing. But it's tended to happen in the past because there's been a very strong sense of political vision or moral values, and those on the receiving end of censorship have tended to offend against those sensibilities. The striking thing, I think, today is how little sense of strong ideas or values or political vision is evident from those that rule society. So censorship has this slightly unhinged quality of not really being attached to enforcing a particular type of view. It seems much more that the sole aim of it is to undermine any sort of public response, which I think suggests an elite in society that's quite insecure and doesn't really understand what it wants for itself. And so the motive then becomes purely to undermine anybody who might question or respond to what they're trying to do, and just to try and undermine that discussion, which is, you know, is quite a new situation today, I think, and one that we've really got to get to grips with and try and understand a lot better, and try as a solution, I think, in developing new forms of politics and new political ideas. I mean, we don't have any sort of discussion just now where there's a positive sense of how society might progress into the future. And if we could engender that type of discussion, then I think, and have the freedom to engender that type of discussion, then I think we'd be a lot better off.
Well, fantastic. So on that note, I'm going to thank Alistair for joining us. And if you want to hear Alistair speak, you'll be able to at an upcoming event that Together is involved with in Edinburgh. A couple of weeks ago, you'd have heard Anne speaking from Edinburgh, Edinburgh Free Streets. Upcoming event on the 25th of July. You can register at the togetherdeclaration.org site on Edinburgh Public Forum, which is who benefits from low traffic neighbourhoods at low emission zones and 20-minute cities, It's going to be happening at the Augustine United Church, which is 41 on George IV Bridge. In Edinburgh. And it's really exciting because as the low emission zones consultations and rollouts are happening, remember that word, rollout, from the first part of the show, as that's happening across Scotland in the different cities, Edinburgh is a test case, there's George Street and other areas, and people are have got many questions. We've seen across the UK many citizens challenging things. We've seen in Oxford, Cowley Road, the impact to retail, hospitality. People like Clint Pugh have lost some of their business, but being vocal and challenge things. We've seen that in Bath with the Ring of Steel and Canterbury. We've seen Cheyenne and others in Cambridge challenging the congestion impositions that are happening without proper engagement of the public and putting the public at the heart of things. And that's as true of the discussion around energize and energy, innovation, and our public sector, as it is, you know, as we talked about with James in the first hour, as it is of what Alistair's been talking about on free speech. And it's as true in terms of measures to mitigate any risks or challenges that we've got, the need to have cost benefit analyses, the need to put our public at the heart of questions when governments make decisions or talk to us, which we've seen in the last 3 years has not been the case. Particularly when it comes to our young people, those that we should protect the most, that we should give a lead to. And I'm really pleased now that my next guest, who many of you will know and be familiar with, because she has been campaigning from the very early days during lockdowns and the challenges about young people, about children in schools, about education, kids. It's Molly Kingsley, who's a co-founder of Us For Them. And welcome to the show. Thank you for joining us today, Molly.
Thank you, Alan.
So, Molly, I mean, basically, just, you know, what a period. I mean, you've been posting quite a lot in the just the last couple of days about some of the, oh, look how badly these impacts have happened on children and young people, the lockdowns, the measures, sort of crocodile tears perhaps from people that were actually out there championing, cheerleading lockdowns, impositions, shutting down schools, accusing anyone who was raising questions about either being a conspiracist or danger or killing granny, all those things. Tell us briefly, firstly, your response to all of that, and then we're going to get into some other things.
Yeah, sure. I mean, I found the last few days really, really upsetting, actually. So, you know, obviously we have the COVID inquiry going on here, which is the UK's public inquiry into the failings of the pandemic period. And I think, you know, from the outset, quite a few of us have feared that this would really just be an opportunity for a whitewash, really, like the people who are being asked to give evidence to this inquiry, by and large, are stakeholders who have a certain pro-lockdown narrative to protect, either because they campaigned very heavily for that, or in many cases, because they were key decision makers who made these lockdown decisions. And school closures, obviously, and you know, various interventions which were harmful to children. And I think certainly from the first couple of weeks, this has been the case. So we have seen really, I think, quite, you know, we've seen some recognition of the damage to children, but actually no one is really saying, and that shouldn't have happened. If anything, actually, it's almost been a series of apologist views for that damage. So, you know, yes, kids were damaged, but actually it was necessary, or it wasn't foreseeable, it wasn't known. And I think for those of us who stood up at the very beginning of the pandemic, as we and, you know, many others did, to hear that it wasn't foreseeable, that it wasn't known, that it wasn't predicted, well, it's just rubbish. It was absolutely foreseeable to parents, many parents actually, that what we were doing in terms of school closures and more generally lockdown was just a disaster for child welfare. And, you know, the idea that policymakers didn't know that is not true. Policymakers were warned, they were warned repeatedly. There are many, many formal documents and ministerial briefing statements throughout the period which very clearly detail the harm. So it's been an infuriating and an upsetting week, I think, in many ways.
I should say as well that whilst this COVID inquiry goes on and is going to be for years and has got a huge amount of costs, and some of the terms of reference and even the ways they've gone about talking about things raise enormous concerns for people, that you actually wrote a book with your colleague, Liz Cole, called The Children's Inquiry. And you also contacted the COVID inquiry in terms of their lack in the initial terms of reference in terms of the consideration for young people, which there was a response to. You, just in terms of campaigning, because I get different campaigners on here, there's a lot of people that are challenging some of the things in terms of measures, traffic measures, lack of democratic accountability. But tell us a little bit what it's like to... Just, you know, you set up with a few of you, you're mothers, you set up Us for Them, and you've had enormous success in terms of some of the areas, you know, mask wearing for children, primary kids in particular, and other areas. But also it's challenging. Just tell us a little bit about that experience, if you would. And if you can give any words of encouragement, if you might want to people who might think that there's egregious impositions and they want to challenge them.
Yeah, I mean, I think you've just got to do it. So, you know, we all have the thought, don't we, about standing up about things and kind of being proactive, even on a local level, you know, like, so I'll give you another example. There's the road by our house that's meant to be a 20 mile an hour area, and it's by school, and, you know, regularly cars are going at like 40 or 50 down it, and it drives me mad. And I must have had this thought, I reckon, like 2000 times, like, something's got to be done about that. I really should contact the council, or, you know, whatever it is. And I've never done it, which is awful. And it's probably the thing that would actually make the most immediate difference to my kid's life. And then I'm kind of in this position now where I'm just like, I feel really bad I've not done it, because if the last few years have taught me anything, it doesn't always take as much as you would think to start something. Like, it, you know, it's ended up being the most tremendous amount of work and just this huge thing. But actually what got it going was just one campaign. You know, we had a website actually specifically about social distancing, which we felt raised all kinds of issues for child welfare. So all we did was, well, not all we did, but, you know, we launched a website, we had one campaign on it, and that didn't feel, that was quite a small step. You know, it took maybe a week to get that going. And there was very, you know, maybe like just one landing page on this website. And on the day we launched, there were just three of us, and that was it. That was the campaign. And it snowballed really from there. And I think if you look back and, you know, if someone has said, like, this is the impact that you would have had, and these are the areas you would be campaigning on. Because, of course, you know, we always have everything we campaign on is seen through the lens of child welfare and sort of children first and putting children front and center in policymaking. But really, that's everything, because, you know, our view is that if you are governing this country properly, you would be looking at it through the lens of, you know, what is right for children today, tomorrow, and in the future. Like, that is how a society flourishes. You look to, you know, children who are really your greatest latent asset, and you think, well, how do we make them fly? So, although, you know, often we're sort of, people say, oh, you know, you're a children's group, you're all about education. There's some truth in that, but I think actually much of what we do, and certainly as we've gone through the years, has been about wider politics. And you know, that, I think what you said actually about the COVID inquiry is a really good example of that. So, you know, we saw as soon as the initial terms of reference of the inquiry were released, we saw that they didn't mention, I mean, they literally did not mention the word children once. And we were just like, what the hell? Like, how dare you? Like, children were in many ways the group of the population that was most badly harmed, most disproportionately harmed anyway by the pandemic. And how could you not consider them? And, you know, by the point this happened, I guess we did have quite good links with some policymakers, and we managed and actually other education and child and political stakeholders as well. So we managed very quickly to get a campaign off the ground, and we did manage to get those terms of referencing, you know, changed to include kids. Whether or not that is actually going to have the desired effect, I don't know. I mean, you know, as I'm sure you'll have seen, Alan, but the COVID inquiry has not yet decided to call the education secretary as a witness, which is really quite shocking, I think, given some of the other people it has decided to call. But no, to Indeed. Get back to your question, go on, sorry.
Pause you there for one second, Molly, because we're going to go to a quick break. I'm with Molly, who's a co-founder of Us For Them, at Us For Them UK, at Lens I See Through. I'm Alan Miller, this is TNT Radio. Stay with us and join us. Come back after this quick break.
Give me a minute with TNT Radio's Steve Malzberg.
Immigration brings with it a whole set of problems that the left dare not discuss. One of the byproducts of having an overflow of migrants, both legal and illegal, in America is that our public schools are being overrun by their kids. The Center for Immigration Studies has done an analysis of recent information from the Census Bureau, and the results are frightening. The report, Mapping the Impact of Immigration on Public Schools. Among the findings, in 2021, 29% of public school students from immigrant households were from households headed by an illegal immigrant, and that doesn't take into account the recent border crisis. The 11 million public school students in 2021 from immigrant-headed households, legal and illegal, accounted for nearly 1 out of 4 students in our public schools. This is double the 11% in 1990 and more than triple the 7% in 1980. Immigration has added significantly to the population of students who speak a foreign language at home. Folks, our kids already can't read or do math up to grade level, and the issues just mentioned are bound to make things a whole lot worse. Thanks for giving me a minute. I'm Steve Malzberg for TNT Radio.
Challenging the consensus and debunking the narrative. This is Viewpoint.
Who is Klaus Schwab, and what is the World Economic Forum which he leads? Klaus Schwab, the chairman of the World Economic Forum, believes transhumanization is a fundamental part of the Great Reset within the Fourth Industrial Revolution. He states, the difference of this Fourth Industrial Revolution is it doesn't change what you are doing. It changes you if you take genetic editing, just as an example. It's you who are changed, and of course this has a big impact on your identity.
This is the Alan Miller Show on today's News Talk, TNT Radio.
Welcome back, everyone. So I am here with Molly, and we were just in the middle of talking about things that can be done in the COVID inquiry, what it means. In this latter part of the show, Molly, I mean, tell us your concerns about the COVID inquiry, what you think it might be able to do in the best instance, and concerns, and then what we might do aside from that, because it's going to take several years in any case. Well, I mean, how do you see that?
Yeah, I mean, you know, as I said, I think it's I think it's problematic, sadly, and I really wish it wasn't, because it ought to be a great opportunity just to have an honest appraisal of, you know, what went right, what didn't go right, what mistakes were made. And I think, as it would say and is saying, you know, lessons learned. It also has, of course, very wide legal powers to require ministers and government officials to hand over evidence, including, as we know, you know, private messages in some cases. And it's hard to see how any other forum is going to give itself such wide-ranging disclosure powers. And, you know, disclosure is really important. Like, disclosure and transparency are the bedrock of democracy. You know, if you can't see how decisions were made, how do you ensure there is accountability, and how do you learn? So there is this potential there, but, you know, I think some of the problems are well trodden by now. I think there seems to be an apparent bias, whether deliberate or not, who knows, but there does seem to be an apparent bias, or perhaps imbalance is a better way of putting it, in the people giving evidence. It is going to take many, many years to get any conclusions at all. And particularly within that, the children module is not until 2024, maybe 2025. I mean, you know, by that point, many of the children who were in school will have left school by that point. This is far, far too late for these kids. I think, you know, that probably the final point I'd make on it is, I'm sure Lady Hallett, who is, you know, a senior judge leading the inquiry, I'm sure she means well and is a person of, you know, great integrity, doubtless. But like many, many others in this period, she will have been reading newspapers and, you know, watching TV programs, which have really been propagating a diet of propaganda and half-truths for 3 years. So if you had only been reading, you know, The Guardian, The Times, you're not going to have a complete view of what has been going on. I mean, frankly, you wouldn't have that from any of the mainstream press. But some, I think, have been more challenging during this period than others. And I think that's really worrying, because bad inputs make for bad outputs. And if you don't have the right people who have been briefed and educated about what has been happening, I don't see how you can expect to get to the right answers. And in particular, the lack of urgency and priority given to children, you know, I know I would say this, but I just find that really perplexing, actually. And it's interesting, actually, Alan. So we applied to be core participants for module one and module two. We didn't get it on either occasion. Different reasons were given. It was surprising, we thought, we didn't get it, because not just because it, you know, of us, but actually because we put in the application in a consortium with about five or six other groups and individuals. One of those individuals included Anne Longfield, who was children's commissioner during the pandemic. So, you know, and we all got refused. The reason that we got refused for module one is because we were told module one was all about pandemic preparedness and not children. And I don't understand that, because I don't understand how you can prepare for a pandemic without considering your 10 million children, who are in some ways the most vulnerable cohort in that pandemic. You know, how can you consider whether or not you are prepared for a pandemic without considering how you're going to keep your schools open, how you're going to safeguard children, how you're going to keep children, and of course others, but, you know, also children, how you're going to keep children having access to the services, the developmental services, the sports, the health services that they need. So I find that troubling. I think it comes from a mindset of someone who doesn't have children at the forefront. And actually, I'm very dubious whether we're going to have anything useful coming out of the inquiry. In fact, I think it might even be worse than that. And we may find it is quite a dangerous whitewash that gives us the opposite answers to what some of us might have hoped for.
You know, on the Us For Them UK, at Us For Them UK site, you guys talk about Sweden quite a lot. It's an important thing. Most people now acknowledge that Anders Tegnell, who was running things there, had a very sensible, rational strategy, particularly around schools and under 16s. And, you know, his quote that you used back in March, again, from 2020, saying we think it's important that children continue with their activities. And in Sweden, you know, they didn't shut schools down or take years out or anything like that after a very, very initial period. So they had a different response, and it's entirely clear that that happened. And also we look at excess deaths in Sweden, and that any COVID inquiry of worth its name should be assessing and evaluating the different strategies and measures and impacts and consequences. And so, you know, I wish you success with that. And anyone who agrees on this issue should actually be getting involved, supporting Molly and us for them. And together we certainly do. And we've been working together to campaign on these things. And another area that you guys have been raising concerns and issues with, and you've written a legal paper on, has been on the WHO, the World Health Organization, part of the United Nations, the Pandemic Treaty and IHR amendments. Just tell us a little bit about your concerns about that, if you would.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I suspect your audience will, you know, this won't be the first time they've heard of this. So I think there is now some growing awareness about what the World Health Organization and member states, you know, it is a member state led process. But what is being proposed here, which is really to turn what had been a advisory body into a body with power to issue, you know, laws effectively, which member states, including the UK, would have to follow. Those edicts would be binding, as things are currently drafted, on citizens, and they include very wide powers to include many of the interventions we saw during COVID. So, you know, under these proposals, the WHO would be able to issue binding lockdowns, binding quarantines, restrictions on travel, mandatory vaccination, including, it would appear, when you look at the documents, on children. So, you know, our concern comes from the fact that we thought that many of the interventions during COVID were not evidence-based, in many cases didn't work, or at least there's limited evidence of efficacy and a lot of evidence of harm. And it seems absolutely insane to give this international body power to hardwire those measures into international law. And of course, it gets even worse. I mean, you only have to say that to think, really, you know, does this make sense? When you actually start digging into the funding structure behind the WHO, the whole thing gets kind of madder and madder. So, you know, again, it's no secret at this point that the WHO is, you know, I think many of us would say, not a benign public funded body. It is a body that is over 80% of it is funded by private interests, and those private interests have the power to dictate its priorities. So because of that, you know, there it effectively follows the profit, and the profit is in medicalized interventions, primarily, not exclusively, vaccines. And I think it has an interest, as is now explicit in some of these proposals, of ensuring that these interventions become, you know, a absolute pillar of international public health, and one actually that potentially is set to be rushed out on, you know, ever expedited approvals basis. We see that as something that is fundamentally at odds with child health. You know, not at all saying that some immunizations aren't important. I think there are traditional vaccines and immunization programs which are very important for child health, but the thought that you know, things like the COVID vaccine would be your primary line of defense for children in a pandemic, well, no, we would not say that at all. We would say good health, prevention, fitness ought to govern. And actually, you know, one of the problems we've got into, I think, certainly as a nation and beyond the UK, is that we have a very, very unhealthy population who are reliant on medicalization instead of primary fitness. So the thought that we're going to be looking to this body, who really, that, you know, that appears more and more to be its ethos, is really troubling.
You ask people to do, just on this issue about the WHO, both the IHR amendments and the treaty in the UK, or anywhere internationally, but specifically the UK.
Yeah, I mean, I think the first thing is write to your MP. And I think one of the really worrying things is that our parliamentarians are asleep at the wheel here. So, you know, as you know, Alan, because we've talked about this a lot, haven't we? There are a small handful of politicians who are waking up or are awake to the scale of this threat and what it means for UK autonomous decision making. I mean, it effectively blows a hole through our ability to decide our own health policy and social policy and also economic policy, actually, given the financial ramifications. But the vast majority of politicians are, you know, naively parroting the WHO press office line, which is, you know, these agreements don't impede national sovereignty. That's just not true. They do, and they do hugely. And I think anyone that is concerned about this becoming a way of national life needs to write to their MP and not take the cut and paste answer that we have seen many MPs giving. And I think, you know, there is some hope. As we know, Alan, there are a number of us with quite big grassroots audiences in the UK who are very attuned to this issue. And I think for many of us, this will become, you know, this could be the defining issue of our children's lifetimes. Like, it really could. It is that big. So the, you know, there is a need to keep honest MPs. There will be moments coming up, I think, in the next 6 months where we will be making much more organized noise about this. So I would urge anyone that is concerned to get involved as that time comes. I think you can find letters for your MPs on the Together website. You can find it on the Us for Them website. You know, they are there, so please do it.
And then, though, we need to remember, don't we, that actually Britain, we were locked down using the Public Health Act. And it was the Public Health Act, not the WHO, who at the time weren't actually saying people should lock down. But it was our own elected representatives who actually locked us down using the Public Health Act. So those points are really important. And it's absolutely the case that managerial technocrats love an international ruling to not have to take responsibility and just say, oh, well, they've said it over there. So that's something we should take very seriously. But also, we've had our own Public Health Act, which meant that they could just lock us down. And that is something that we've encouraged people to be focused on as well, because it's crucial, right? In the sense that they didn't need to do anything else. They didn't even need the emergency measures that which they passed that then get lapsed. But they actually had a piece of legislation they could just use, and they just locked us down. And perhaps the idea that never again lockdowns are not the solution as a kind of mechanism, as an intervention, just ad hoc that you impose on people, and that we must insist on certain things like cost benefit analysis, what the public really needs, a calm, reasonable response, a bit like the old pandemic preparedness strategy being brought back in. But lockdowns in particular, not again. What's your thought on that?
Yeah, I mean, I think you're exactly right. I think in reality, you know, every constitutional check and balance failed during the pandemic. You know, it should be in times of emergency. You have a heightened need, actually, for democratic scrutiny and accountability. And instead, that was stripped because, in theory, there wasn't time. I think many of us wouldn't buy that. Many of us would say, well, actually, it's, you know, when you're making these very draconian laws, like, generally good laws are made when they have been subject to testing, to rigorous debate, to review, and none of that happened. And I think there is absolutely a need to look at our constitutional safeguards. I know there's various groups doing just this behind the scenes. You know, I know Together are doing a lot on that. And I think it's the whole package, really, of measures to say, you know, what should we do in an emergency situation? And really, this is exactly what the public inquiry should be doing. But if the public inquiry is coming at it from the point of view of, well, you know, how do we lock down even harder and faster next time, then clearly none of this will be given the airtime it needs to be.
I want to thank you, Molly, for all the work you've done. And you're always really clear, and it's inspiring to be around you, to work with you. And you know, one of the things about this show is we get people from around the country of all different walks of life who have sort of raised their head above the parapet. It obviously comes at a cost, but when we do it, that's the thing that's really infectious. And you've definitely, you and some other women at Us for Them, Liz Cole and others have really kind of shone the light on things. If you want to leave us with one thought just before we end, or a word of encouragement, what would it be? Any reflections for us?
Well, thank you. That's kind, Alan. I mean, I think the encouragement that I see is that although this period has been really shocking in many respects, it has brought together people from so many different walks of life who wouldn't have been brought together, you know, the very fact we're having this conversation. And I think actually I do see hope. I don't know when it will happen, but I do think there are enough of us now who are so disillusioned with what has happened and actually see no other option but to get involved in whatever way, you know, that can mean different things, but to get involved in politics, in public life, and actually in making sure that we leave, you know, our political framework and institutions in a better shape than we found them in 2020. So I think there is hope. Yeah.
Thank you so much, Molly. We're going to have to go in a second, but I really appreciate it. I'd love to get you back again soon. Molly Kingsley, Us For Them, big shout. And remember, tomorrow, Marble Arch, Anti-ULEZ Challenge. Everyone get down there. I'm Alan Miller. This is TNT Radio. I'll see you next week. Stay free. Stay critical.